This is study number 8 in our camp meeting in Tananda, South Australia, 1992. So let us now turn again to the statement that we find on page 125 in the book Last Day Events. And this, as I mentioned already, is a statement from some manuscripts, exactly Spall and Megan collection, page 1, if you happen to have this. But you have all the book, the Last Day Events, so you can read the statement on page 125 and following. Again, we begin to read in the beginning. I saw the nominal church and nominal Adventists like Judas would betray us to the Catholics to obtain their influence to come against the truth. In our last study, we asked the question, why would Adventists go to the Catholics to betray God's people? Why would they do this? And it sounded very strange that they would do this, because they are Sabbath keepers, and God's people will be Sabbath keepers in the end. They are waiting for Christ's soon coming, for they are Adventists by name, and God's people are waiting for Christ's soon coming, so they are very similar to them. And one hint that was given was that this is not different than it was in history. And we mentioned the fact that in the time of Jesus there were two parties in the Jewish church. They were called, you still remember? Pharisees and Sadducees. You remember who they were and what they believed? Yes, that was the main point of controversy, even though there were many others. You could generally say the Sadducees were the modernists who believed only what they saw, really, as scientists do today, what they see and what they can scientifically prove. And the Pharisees, they were the conservatives, those who believed in the Word of God as it was transmitted over the generations. Today we have also two groups, really, in the same manner. Well, and when Jesus came to this earth, he, of course, certainly believed in the truth of the resurrection. He certainly believed in angels and things like this, what the Sadducees did not. Even though Jesus was not the special enemy of the Sadducees, they never really tried to persecute him. Their enemies were the Pharisees more than Jesus. But when Jesus preached the resurrection with a power that was incontrovertible, then the Sadducees really began to hate him. Let's read about this. We find a wonderful description of this in the chapter after the chapter on Lazarus. Lazarus come forth, and after this, something like controversy or so. I must have a quick look. 58, yeah. Priestly plottings, that is the chapter I'm thinking of. Let's open page 537. 537 in Desire of Ages. That is the 59th chapter, Priestly Plottings. The Sadducees, though not favorable to Christ, had not been so full of malignity toward him as were the Pharisees. Their hatred had not been so bitter. You could say they were not so fanatical as were the Pharisees. The Pharisees, they were real zealots in some respects of their old beliefs, and they were the quarrelers more than the Sadducees. The Sadducees were more concerned with position, of getting the highest position in the Jewish church. That was not so much the concern of the Pharisees. Their concern was more the right beliefs. And therefore, they hated Christ because they believed that he was not keeping tradition, healing on the Sabbath, for example, and things like this. So the hatred of the Pharisees had not been so bitter, but they were now thoroughly alarmed. Why were the Sadducees alarmed? Because Jesus had obviously resurrected a person that had been 3 days dead. And that was so obvious, and with so many witnesses, and that you couldn't deny it. It was simply a fact. And so they were thoroughly alarmed. It is strange, isn't it? Instead of changing their doctrines, they wanted to kill the one who gave evidence to the falsity of their doctrines. That you call science, when it must not be true what... No, how do you say? It is not true what must not be true. That is how science often happens, isn't it? When a scientist has a certain doctrine in his head, he will put every effort to disprove something that disproves his theory. And this is exactly what the Sadducees were. Now, they claimed that they were very reasonable and very scientific, but here shows that all this was a false testimony. They were now thoroughly alarmed. They did not believe in a resurrection of the dead. Producing so-called science, they had reasoned that it would be an impossibility for a dead body to be brought to life. But by a few words from Christ, their theory had been overthrown. They were shown to be ignorant both of the scriptures and the power of God. They could see no possibility of removing the impression made upon the people by the miracle. How could men be turned away from him who had prevailed to rob the grave of its dead? Lying reports were put in circulation, but the miracle could not be denied. And how to counteract its effect, they knew not. Thus far, the Sadducees had not encouraged the plan of putting Christ to death, but after the resurrection of Lazarus, they decided that only by his death could his fearless denunciations against them be stopped. So, to kill the one who gave that evidence, that was now their plan. The Pharisees believed in the resurrection, and therefore they should have sided with Christ, shouldn't they? Should have triumphed, in fact. And they could not but see that this miracle was an evidence that the Messiah was among them. But they had ever opposed Christ's work. From the first, they had hated him because he had exposed their hypocritical pretensions. He had torn aside the cloak of rigorous rites under which their moral deformity was hidden. The pure religion that he taught had condemned their hollow professions of piety. They thirsted to be revenged upon him for his pointed rebukes. They had tried to provoke him to say or do something that would give them occasion to condemn him. Several times they had attempted to stone him, but he had quietly withdrawn, and they had lost sight of him. The miracles he performed on the Sabbath were all for the relief of the afflicted, but the Pharisees had sought to condemn him as a Sabbath breaker. They had tried to arouse the Herodians against him. They represented that he was seeking to set up a rival kingdom and consulted with them how to destroy him. To excite the Romans against him, they had represented him as trying to subvert their authority. They had tried every pretext to cut him off from influencing the people, but so far their attempts had been foiled. The multitudes who witnessed his works of mercy had heard his pure and holy teachings, knew that these were not deeds of a Sabbath breaker and blasphemer. Even the officers sent by the Pharisees had been so influenced by his words that they could not lay hands on him. In desperation, the Jews had finally passed an edict that any man who professed faith in Jesus should be cast out of the synagogue. Now, that was a power that went with Jesus, when even the spies from the Pharisees were impressed by him. That reminds me a little bit of Paul. You know, Paul was put in chain in Rome, and every day he got a different soldier, because when this soldier was with him in chains, he would talk about the gospel with him and he would soon be converted. And so they had to take a new soldier, which again was converted after a day. And they took a new soldier and they had to change. They changed all the time. And even the spies they sent out were impressed by Jesus. That's power, isn't it? That attended the people of God here. Okay, that's only a by-point. Now, can you see how the Pharisees hated him? Another thought that comes into my mind in this context is, was Jesus not a little bit too uncareful? In other words, would he have not made the Pharisees an enemy before, they would have seen the evidence and would have sided with Jesus, and he would have won them. Wouldn't this be an argument? In other words, they only hated him the more because of this miracle, because they hated him even before. Yeah. The fact is really that Christ would not have won them through the greatest miracle in their favor, even not the resurrection of the dead. He could not have won them. If they reject the truths that came from the lips of Jesus, they would reject everything else, because they were preached with the power of God. Of course, here they set the stage and they went further and further, even though it was not too late for them when Jesus came. They could still have reverted. But at that point of time, when Jesus resurrected Lazarus, it was already very late. Too late, in fact. And they had set their hearts against Jesus, and even this miracle could not turn them around. So we read on, "So as the priests, the rulers, and the elders gathered for consultation, it was their fixed determination to silence him with who did such marvelous works, that all men wondered. Pharisees and Sadducees were more nearly united than ever before." Most strange when you think about this. Now, we have no idea how they really hated each other because of resurrection, but think of Paul for a moment. He was really hated by both of them, and they took him before the Sanhedrin, and Paul needed simply to say, "I stand here because of the resurrection." And suddenly they left him and they quarreled with each other. The Pharisees saying, "This guy is not too bad, he believes in the resurrection." And the Sadducees then really became angry, and then they crushed against each other. And in this turn, the Romans had to come and take away Paul from them, because it is strange. The Sadducees were so out of themselves that they tried to kill him, they and the Sanhedrin. And the Pharisees thought, well, maybe he's not too bad because he believes in the resurrection, and they tried to protect him. And so there was, like in the Russian parliament, you know, have you seen this picture a few days ago, where they discussed some things and they couldn't discuss in peace anymore, and so they began to fight with each other, these high dignitaries of the state. It was a funny picture, really. Yeah, I talk now of Paul. This, I just mentioned Paul's incident to show how they really hated each other on that point. And that on that very point where Jesus gave evidence of the resurrection, they could be more nearly united. That is strange, isn't it? It is very difficult to explain according to human logic, but let us think of the deeper reasons. Now, the deeper reasons were rejection of truth, were hatred of truth, in fact. Now, rejection of truth eventually turns in hatred of truth. And this hatred of truth was so strong that it superseded all other consideration and all other feelings that they had. It would even supersede feelings of mercy and compassion and whatever was left of that. They would be willing to kill anybody for hatred of truth. And that shows what will happen when the image of the beast is erected. Then, nominal Adventists, that are those who have not the life of the message, but have only the name, will actually go to the Catholics, who are their greatest enemies, and they will join together with them in order to get their influence against the truth, and that they will do out of hatred of truth only. That is the deeper reason for it. Hatred of truth can be so strong that it supersedes everything else. That we have seen maybe in a small degree, or some of us have seen this in a small degree, but this will be nothing as it will be then. Let us be warned by history. As history has been, so it will be again. So they were more nearly united than ever before. It says further, "Divided hitherto, they became one in their opposition to Christ. Nicodemus and Joseph had, in former councils, prevented the condemnation of Jesus, and for this reason they were now summoned, They were present at the council other influential men who believed on Jesus, but their influence prevailed nothing against that of the malignant Pharisees. Yet the members of the council were not all agreed. The Sanhedrin was not at this time a legal assembly. It existed only by tolerance. Some of its number questioned the wisdom of putting Christ to death. They feared that this would excite an insurrection among the people, causing the Romans to withhold further favors from the priesthood and to take from them the power they still held. The Sadducees were united in their hatred of Christ, yet they were inclined to be cautious in their movements, fearing that the Romans would deprive them of their high standing. In this council, assembled to plan the death of Christ, the witnesses was present, sorry, in this council assembled to plan the death of Christ, the witness was present who heard the boastful words of Nebuchadnezzar, who witnessed the idolatrous feast of Belshazzar, who was present when Christ in Nazareth announced himself the Anointed One. This witness was now impressing the rulers with the work they were doing, and so forth. I think I don't need to read much further. When you read the story on, you will find that finally the Sadducees and Pharisees united with the Herodians. And the Herodians, that were those who were followers of Herod, obviously. And Herod was the governor under the Roman jurisdiction. In other words, they were the loyalists, we would say today. Those who would be loyal to the government, while the priests were not very loyal. They only were loyal as far as they could get advantage from the state, but they didn't really like the Romans. They would have rather gotten rid of them. But the Herodians, they were really in favor of the governors. And so, even though these sects all hated with each other, now they all came together in one pot in their hatred against Jesus. And so likewise, in the end, we have here in that statement actually three different parties. Let's read about them again. I saw the nominal church and nominal Adventists, like Judas would betray us to the Catholics. So we have nominal church. Nominal churches would be Sunday keepers. Nominal Adventists, that would be those who believe in the soon coming of Christ and would keep the Sabbath. And they together would betray us to the Catholics. Now, the question is, why do they need to betray us to the Catholics? Why don't the Catholics go ahead in going against us? It's not the Catholics primarily who go against God's people. Why is it the nominal Adventists and the nominal churches?
Because they had so much love for him. And then that hatred is, like Jesus said, sometimes boast. Mm-hmm. And therefore the hatred would be so much more.
That's right. Again, it is hatred of truth. Herod, for example, was not such a hater of Jesus, neither was Pilate. It was the Pharisees mainly, and the Sadducees with them, the religionists of the country who hated the truth that Jesus was preaching. And so likewise, at that time, it will be those who have most nearly rejected the truth. Now the Catholics, we must see this very clearly, they also have rejected the truth, but that happened long, long, long ago. The Catholics have rejected the truth practically centuries ago, and then again in the time of Reformation, when the gospel was coming to them through Luther and other reformers. Meanwhile, they have certainly fallen lower, but they have not so much contact with present truth. But who has most contact with present truth? Well, that's right. Those who have been in the message and gone out. Those are those who have been most nearly in contact with the message. Therefore, they are those who are most directly involved in that. And this will be confirmed as we read on. So they will betray us to the Catholics to obtain the influence to come against the truth. The saints then will be an obscure people. Obscure means not well known. That's right. Oh, that little group, what do they matter? That's right. Yeah, good. The saints then will be an obscure people, little known to the Catholics, but the churches and nominal Adventists who know of our faith and customs. Now that are those who know of our faith and customs. How do they know? That's right, by being very acquainted with it. They, for they hated us on account of the Sabbath, for they could not refute it, will betray the saints and report them to the Catholics as those who disregard the institutions of the people, that is, that they keep the Sabbath and disregard Sunday. Yes, I always read the same statement here. So let us see this, that the nearer people are to the truth, the more acquainted they are, the more hateful they will be when it is presented. The Pharisees have been nearest to Jesus in some respects, haven't they? Therefore, they were the greatest haters of Jesus. Then came the Sadducees, who have not been so much involved with Jesus, but later they became, when he gave evidence of the falsity of their doctrines, and then they became haters. And then it went out further to the Herodians, and further, and the further it spread, the more haters he got. And so likewise here. First of all, those will be haters of truth who have been most nearest with us. Then come those who have been aparted earlier probably, and finally the whole world will hate God's people because they hate the truth that they are preaching. Let's read a little bit further in that statement. It says then the Catholics bid the Protestants to go forward and issue a decree that all who will not observe the first day of the week instead of the seventh day shall be slain. And the Catholics, whose numbers are large, will stand by the Protestants. The Catholics will give their power to the image of the beast, and the Protestants will work as their mother worked before them to destroy the saints. But before their decree bring or bear fruit, the saints will be delivered by the voice of God. That's a big summary. It puts together a long period of time. So the Catholics then bid the Protestants go forward. Now, what was the cause of all this, that the Catholics bid the Protestants go forward and go to the state and say that they shall be punished and so forth? It was that we were betrayed to the Catholics. By whom? By those who hated the truth because they could not refute it. So, who then will be foremost in erecting the image of the beast? Worldwide. Those who have apostatized from the Church of God. Now, can you see the truth of the statement? It is apostasy in the church that leads to the erection of the image of the beast. Can you see this connection? Let's read this again in Great Controversy quickly. Page 443 and 444. It was apostasy that led the early church to seek the aid of the civil government, and this prepared the way for the development of the papacy, the beast. Said Paul, there shall come a falling away, and that men of sin be revealed. So, apostasy in the church will prepare the way for the image to the beast. Apostasy in the church. I don't know how you understood this when you read this in the past. So, apostasy in the church will prepare the way for the image of the beast, or to the beast. It's the same, I think. In the German translation of this little paragraph here, I should mention that there are two words for church in German. There's one word which signifies the big churches, and another word which signifies the small church, which we consider ourselves. It is the word community, literally translated. Gemeinde, yeah, that's right. Community, it would be literally translated. And it's interesting, in the translation, I don't know whether the translator were aware of this, it says, though apostasy in the community, in the little church, will prepare the way for the image of the beast. It would be much more comfortable to say, so apostasy in the church, in the big churches. But no, the church, which is the church of God, isn't it? It's apostasy from truth. Otherwise, it would not be apostasy, which leads the way for the setting up of the image of the beast. Yeah, I'm not aware of this. Yeah?
When the apostles, so they enlightened that they go against the truth, well, what they must see light somewhere to cause them to go against it, to go with the other, with the Catholic, to go against it.
No. Maybe I did not express myself clearly. Let us repeat this, okay? Let's repeat this. Now, okay, let's repeat it again. Now, it is those who are acquainted with our faith and customs who will go to the Catholics to betray us. Those who are acquainted with our faith and customs. That means those who stand nearest or once stood nearest to us, like Judas. Judas was a member of the body of Christ. And then he went to betray Christ. And he was the more effective because he was a member of the body of Christ. Had he never been a member of the body of Christ, he wouldn't have been very effective. But because he was a member, he was very effective. So likewise, those who once were a member of the body will go to the Catholics to betray us. Why do they go? Because they hate us on account of the truth They can't refute it. That are the nominal Adventists. And of course, every one who will apostatize from this truth. It is apostasy in the church. And you can say, in a certain sense, this may be also Adventists who are not particular of this movement because they have become acquainted with the truth and they hate the truth of this. But I would say primarily everyone who has become very acquainted with the truth and hates it becomes to hate it. Now, when we see the chain of events, we see that when they go to the Catholics, they will not feel very guilty doing it. They will say, we do not like the Catholics, they are not our friends, and they don't become our friends when we go to them, but because we must get rid of this message that is preached so powerful, we will go to them and we will use their means to get rid of them. It's the same thing as going today to court against somebody whom you think does you injustice, isn't it? The court is not our friend, is he? The judge is there in the court. They're not our particular friends whom we would trust normally. But when they go against us, then we tend to go them, then we tend to justify and say, yes, it must happen because they are so bad. It's the same thing. The image of the beast is always something where I do not have the power of God anymore, therefore I go to another power. Now, why do the nominal Adventists go to the Catholics? Sister White gives the reason. It says they go to the Catholics to obtain the influence, to come against the truth, and then, where was it again? For their number is large. You remember this? Did I read it? Mm-hmm. But the children nominal and the Catholics, whose numbers are large, will stand by the Protestants. So why will they go to the Catholics? Because the numbers is large, and that means they have power. That's the reason. In other words, they are the only ones that can stop them. So we must go to them. Yeah, yeah.
This is why I fear more from within and from our tribe.
Yeah. Okay, let's again read this statement in the Great Controversy. So apostasy in the church will prepare the way for the image to the beast. Let's now come back to Moses, because there we left the story. We wanted to show how serious it was that Moses took the sword into his own hand. That was, in fact, the same thing. He was not relying on the power of God, but on the power of the sword to solve his problems. Now, the natural result of this was that this same sword was turned against him. The people of Israel had the same means in their hands as Moses had. And therefore, when he tried to pacify two Israelites that quarreled with each other, what did they do? They turned on him with the same means. That is, with a sword. They themselves didn't have a sword, like the Egyptians. But what did they do then? They turned to the Egyptians against Moses. Let's read about this now in Patriarchs and Prophets. I thought I had it here. Yep. In the chapter Moses, which page was this again? 246, thank you. Mm-hmm. Good, on page 247, let's begin on page 246. They were not prepared for freedom. On the following day, Moses saw two Hebrews striving together, one of them evidently at fault. Moses reproved the offender, who at once retaliated upon the reprover, denying his right to interfere, and basely accusing him of crime. Who made thee a prince and a judge over us, he said. Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And he said this very openly, and the Egyptians were there and so forth. So what did he obviously intend? He intended to defend himself against Moses by using the power of the Egyptians, that is, using the sword. In fact, the same thing as Moses had done. And the next thing that Moses had to do was quickly make himself out of the way. As it says, the whole matter was quickly made known to the Egyptians and greatly exaggerated, soon reached the ears of Pharaoh. It was represented to the king that this act meant much, that Moses designed to lead his people against the Egyptians to overthrow the government and to seat himself upon the throne, and that there could be no security for the kingdom while he lived. It was at once determined by the monarch that he should die, but becoming aware of his danger, he made his escape and fled toward Arabia. And then we read something about the slaying of the Egyptian in the paragraph after the next on page 247 now. In slaying the Egyptian, Moses had fallen into the same error so often committed by his fathers of taking their own hands, into their own hands, the work that God had promised to do. It was not God's will to deliver his people by warfare, as Moses thought, but by his own mighty power, that the glory might be ascribed to him alone. What a significant statement. Here we have two possible means of deliverance from Egypt. The one warfare, and the other God's power. And God intended that only by his power should they be delivered. He could have used the sword, couldn't he? Since they had this wrong concept. But why didn't God use the sword? Well, at other times God permitted them to use the sword, didn't he? He permitted it with Abraham. That's right.
Yeah, he permitted them.
Yeah, they were like little children who got their first lessons now.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. They were like a little babe. Furthermore, the deliverance from Egypt had to be a type for us who are living in the last days of the time. Exactly as the Israelites were delivered from Egypt, so we must be delivered from the image of the beast, and in no other way. And in order to teach us the lesson very clearly that there is not the least particle of the sword to be used in our deliverance from the image of the beast, that had to happen like this. It was especially for our sakes that the Lord did it like this. And this we should remember very clearly. For this reason, the story of the deliverance of the Israelites from Egypt contains priceless lessons for us. It is just what we need. And here we see how useless it is to use the sword. Let us now read several statements concerning the sword. The first in Revelation 13. Verse 10, he that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with a sword must be killed with a sword. So if he would use the sword, what would happen to us? We will be killed with a sword. What will happen to the image of the beast? It will be killed by the sword. We will show this later in our study. Let's turn to Matthew 26, I think. Verse 52, Matthew 26, verse 52. And there it says, put, that is after Peter cut off the ear of the servant of the high priest, put up again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. You may say that is unjust, because shortly before, Jesus had told his disciples they should take a sword. Didn't he? You know this? But we must understand that Jesus talked of the spiritual sword when he talked to them, that they should take a sword, not the physical sword, the sword of the Spirit. And they thought, of course, it was the physical sword and took that. And here they learned an important lesson, because immediately when they used it, Jesus counteracted that work. He, instead of helping him to fight, he healed the man whose ear was cut off. That was a lesson, wasn't it? And together with the words, take the sword into his place, for all that take the sword shall perish with the sword. There's a deep, very deep meaning in the words of Jesus, take up thy sword into his place. There's a place for the sword, which we will consider later, but it is not in the hands of the people of God. Surely not. We shall have nothing to do with the sword whatsoever, and if we would, we would perish together with the sword. And so everybody who in the end will, because of lack of the power of God, take refuge to the sword and take it in his own hand, he will perish by it, together with the image of the beast. And what terrible fate that will be is described in Revelation 14 in the third angel's message, which is the most fearful description of the judgment that those will have who worship the image and the beast, as we have seen in our first study. So let us see very clearly from this that as God's people, we will have nothing to do with the swords whatsoever. It will be rather those who depend on the sword who will be foremost and the cause in erecting the image of the beast. That is the cause. They will try to quench the truth, the mighty truth. So they will go to the Catholics. The Catholics will betray. The Catholics will then tell the Protestants they shall go to the state. Protestants will go to the state. He will make laws. And these laws will be enacted against God's people. And in this time, we can rely only on the power of God to deliver us from it. It will look at some times as though God will not deliver us, but in the end, the victory will be very complete, very total. Let us always remember that there's a power much stronger than the power of the sword, and that is the power of God, which is the power of love, which is the truth. And this must be in our hearts so that we do not fall in the hour of temptation, but that we are kept. These thoughts we want to close for this evening, as our time is over again.